First struggle, he became appointed secondary Tsar and basically kept out of the palace as much as possible, forced to live with his mother in a village nearby Moscow. Only after 1689, when Sophia was deposed, partly because she tried to seize complete power, both from her brother and her half-brother, but also due to discontents with different aspects of her reign, only then did Peter really formally begin to rule at the age of 17, though in fact he wasn't all that interested in ruling, and he left it to the hands of his mother until she died. You'll hear more about that next time. What's worth dwelling on is that Peter's childhood at this point was a remarkably free one, especially in his years of virtual exile from the Kremlin between the ages of 10 and 17. Bored by life away from the Kremlin, nothing much went on, and really getting rather sick of listening to his mother constantly weeping and complaining about how she'd been excluded from power, he spent his time in more entertaining surroundings, above all among the soldiers and foreigners of the foreign quarter. In fact, he loved the soldier's life so much that he created his own private play regiment when he was 11 years of age. And as he was formerly Tsar, he can do a lot to create a play regiment. He could command men, he could build a fortress, and he most enjoyed while in his play army, which were of real men that he commanded, but he was out of power, and so it was a bit of a game at this stage. His favorite role was as drummer. He liked to bang the drum as loudly as possible, by the way. And at one point, while engaged in this military game, he found a dilapidated English sailboat and said, "Great, I think I'll build a navy, too," which Russia did not have. His interest in technical matters, of course, partly is what led him to the foreign settlement. People who could teach him crafts, like how to fix up this boat. And indeed, while in the foreign quarter, he met all sorts of foreigners. One of his closest friends was a Dutchman named Franz Timmerman, who taught Peter mathematics and fortification. But he also made friends with foreign military officers, as well as some low-born Russians hanging around the neighborhood. All of this shaped how he thought about the world and how he looked as well. He began to look like the men he spent his time among, not to dress in the heavy robes of the Muscovite aristocrat, and he was, after all, Tsar himself, though not one really holding power, but to look like a foreigner, wearing foreign clothes, and when he got old enough to shave, at best he'd wear a little foreign-looking mustache. It's worth saying, though, that his time in this foreign settlement was not entirely or only edifying. He was a man of great energy, of great appetites. This led him to learn about math and science and boat making and about the world, but it also led him to drink heavily, to dance furiously, and to enjoy the charms of foreign women, something that was not allowed in mainstream Muscovite society, where women were kept in isolation. Here was a man who was energetic and curious, voracious in many respects, a man of great energy. Next time, we'll look at how he applied these energies, these appetites, to remaking Russia.
Lecture 3, Peter the Great's Revolution.
As I mentioned last time, Peter the Great was viewed by many contemporaries and Russians as transforming the very nature of Russia as a nation, what it meant to be a Russian, as a ruler who, in other words, forced Russia, perhaps kicking and screaming, into the modern European world. And in part, as we've seen last time, this was a myth. But it was not, as we'll see in this lecture, entirely fanciful. This lecture looks at the reign of Peter the First, Peter the Great as he became known, who ruled as Tsar from 1682 to 1725. It looks at his personality and his values as a ruler, as an individual. It looks at his most important reforms. And most importantly, it looks at the meaning of these reforms, especially the meanings of his efforts to modernize Russia, to westernize Russia. As I mentioned last time, at the age of 10, Peter the Great became a co-tsar of Russia as Peter the First, alongside his half-brother, Ivan V, the son of Tsar Alexei, Peter the Great's father, and Alexei's first wife. And in fact, the two czars ruled together as co-czars until 1696, when Ivan died. At the age of 17, though, the regent Sophia, also Peter's half-sister, the daughter of Alexei and his first wife, was deposed from power. She ruled as regent up until this point. This was in 1689, and this happened when she tried to seize full control of the throne. She was overthrown, though, in part also because she was seen as too pro-Western, as being too connected to the foreigners whose role in Russia was increasing. And in fact, it's rather telling that almost immediately after Sophia was deposed, and it was essentially Peter's mother who had control over affairs since Peter was still off gallivanting about in the foreign quarter, a rather traditionalist reaction set in. Peter, of course, is busy studying technology and shipbuilding and was happy to leave the state in the hands of his mother and other relatives, including the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. These people did everything they could for a short period of time to set back the clock of Russia's westernization. Traditional religiosity, for example, was strongly encouraged. Many Jesuits and other foreign clergy, whose influence was feared as possibly corrupting the true faith, were simply expelled from the country. But even within the church itself, dissenting views, arguments about possible changes in church liturgy or church ideas were violently, vehemently suppressed. General warnings were issued by the government, Peter's mother and the patriarch in particular, to interrogate any foreigner who wanted to come to the country under the assumption they're all dangerous, and to reconsider the presence of every foreigner who was there, to suspect them all as being a dangerous presence in Russia. In fact, the patriarch, the head of the church, who was very close to the ruling family, announced that he believed it was time to end the employment of all foreigners in Russia, and, as an important first step in that, to reject all toleration of foreign faiths, to expel all non-Orthodox from the country, which, of course, would make it impossible for foreigners who weren't Orthodox to live there. The army was even told to stop training in the Western manner. In fact, the atmosphere became so oppressive that many foreigners began thinking about leaving the country, and indeed some did. Indeed, some of them quite prominent and important foreigners, such as the Scottish military leader, General Patrick Gordon, a close friend of Peter the Great, the commander of the Russian armies, as had been chosen by Alexei, Peter's father, for this role. He said, the time has come to leave Russia. Russia is not going toward the West anymore. Despite all this, though, the forces of westernization remained in some ways persistent, at least in the circle that Peter the Great spent his time in. He spent as much time as possible, indeed all his time now, in the foreign settlement, where he learned to speak Dutch, which would come in handy later when he traveled to Western Europe. He learned to fence. He learned to ride horses in the Western manner. He learned to dance new styles of dance, all, again, very Western and very forbidden in the Russian traditional context, certainly by the church. And he insisted that everybody associated with him, his court as co-czar, behaved and dressed in a completely Western manner. Symbolically, one might say, Peter did everything he could to indicate where he personally, as ruler, co-ruler anyway, stood in what might be called the culture wars of the time. In his dress, totally Western. In his lack of beard, or at best, a mustache. In his recreations, the way he danced, for example. And even concerning very important rituals. It's telling that when Peter the Great's son was born, his first son, Alexei, with whom later he had great conflicts because of Alexei's distaste for everything his father stood for. Nonetheless, not knowing where his son was going to head, he had this event celebrated in a very telling manner. In the traditional manner, ringing of church bells and a church service, but also great banquets, fireworks, gun salutes, totally alien to the Russian tradition. And in fact, several traditionalist Muscovites complain that these fireworks and gun salutes, and I quote, disturbed the saints of Moscow. One might say that's exactly what Peter had in mind. In a lot of ways, these two czars, co-czars, Peter and Ivan, who ruled together from 1682 to 1696, a substantial period, visibly symbolized the two choices that Russia faced at the end of the 17th century, the two paths before which Russia at this point stood and was clearly vacillating. On the one hand, pious, if, by the way, not especially bright. In fact, some people believe him to be slightly crazy. Ivan V, who was to be seen walking about the city, followed by his court, in the heavy brocaded robes of a Muscovite ruler. And I mean walking. At one point, Peter suggested that they travel together to a nearby pilgrimage site near Moscow. And Peter had a great idea, take him in his boat that Peter had just built, a rather newfangled contraption from the point of view of Ivan, who absolutely refused to travel in such an unorthodox thing and insisted on walking all the way. On the other hand, one sees Peter, decked out in European dress, no beard, hardly the sign of an Orthodox man, riding horses, sailing in his boats, dashing about the country in between shipyards and military parades, and most importantly, making it clear that he found Russia's traditional ways to be backward, embarrassing, and most importantly, in his view, harmful for a country that wished to be and to be seen as a great power amidst the great powers of Europe. Now, when Peter's mother died in 1694, and his half-brother Ivan was already at this stage rather weak and ailing and able to play little part in power and would die 2 years later, at this point, Peter decided the time had really come to take control. This is 1694, approximately. His mother died in 1694. In other words, the time had come to really act in dramatic public ways on his inclinations and his values, and, of course, to stop this retreat to old Muscovy that was taking place under his mother. Now he would act publicly. Now, to understand the inclinations and values he brought to power, though, it's necessary to look more closely at Peter himself than we already have, more closely about his personality, what we know about his public persona. First, it's important to know that Peter was, at the very first thing you'd notice about him, an enormously large man, physically very tall and very big. He was 6'7" tall, very tall for a Russian. But no less important, people noticed his enormous energy as an individual. Literally, if you were walking with Peter and talking about some important matter, you probably, if you were most ordinary people, would have to run just to keep up. Not only were his strides so enormous, but he was always in a hurry to get places. And this energy, this forcefulness, was a personality trait that was in many ways emblematic of his whole reign. Like no other ruler before him, and it wouldn't be repeated again until Catherine the Great's time, and it remained rare in Russian history, he was enormously optimistic as a ruler, positive about what could be accomplished, active in trying to realize his goals. And this was translated into politics. He believed profoundly that government, his government, had a positive, active role to play in the nation's life. Related personality trait that also was characteristic of him, but translated into his style of being a ruler, is he had a remarkable obsession with work, with physical work. He loved to make things. He made model boats. He eventually made big boats. He made his own furniture. He made crockery. And in fact, after his death, a huge collection of these things can be found, things made by Peter the Great's hand. Sometimes he'd make the very hatchet with which he would cut out wood for building some project. He also fancied himself a rather good surgeon and a particularly good dentist. In fact, if you were a member of Peter the Great's court, you really tried to avoid mentioning to him whether or not you were sick, because he would surely bring out his tool bag and go to work on you. He especially liked to pull teeth. And in fact, a huge bag of teeth was left after his death. You can see it in a museum right now in St. Petersburg. The teeth pulled by Peter the Great, all numbered and marked as whose tooth it was. He was an orderly man, too. Most significantly, though, as a young man, he traveled to Europe in disguise, but nobody was fooled by his disguise. He's a 6'7" tall Russian, after all, who spoke Dutch, but still with an accent. He went in order, above all, to learn a variety of techniques, industrial techniques, and skills for the purpose of making things. Earlier, He, in fact, already got the idea of sending Russians, young Russians, to Western Europe to learn technical skills, especially shipbuilding and navigation, which Russians knew nothing about. And when they'd return, he'd personally examine them to make sure they had really learned what they were supposed to learn. And by the way, with Peter, if you didn't learn what you were supposed to learn, you could be in big trouble before this big man. Himself, though, in 1697, this is the time when he's really now fully in control of the country, primarily, or at least ostensibly, with the goal of putting together a diplomatic coalition of Western powers to fight the Ottoman Empire, with whom Russia had constant conflicts and was constantly seeking to expand at the Ottoman Empire's expense. But really, primarily, his goal was to learn firsthand about the Europe he only knew from the foreign quarter and from foreigners. In fact, he did what no Russian czar ever had done before. And remember, this is a time when he's actually fully in power. His mother is dead. Sophia is long gone. Ivan V is now dead. He personally spent an extended period of time in the West. He spent, in fact, well over a year, 18 months in Western Europe, meeting other heads of state when he wasn't in his disguise, but also in disguise, dressed as his favorite, a simple ship's carpenter, in order to learn the needed crafts he felt his country needed. In many ways, you can probably see his relation to the West was above all about technique, about technology. He was little interested in European music, though it was a great time to hear European music when he traveled in the early, late 17th century, or art or literature. This was really not of great interest to him. Another interesting limitation, one might say, on his attraction to Western culture, rooted in his personality, was what might be described as a sort of remarkable personal crudeness about this man so determined to civilize his nation. He reveled in great noises, remembering pounding his drum in his little military regiments. Buffoonery, he loved practical jokes, horseplay of all sorts, and he drank prodigiously. He was a big man, it made it possible, and he insisted that everybody drink as much as he did. In fact, the most remarkable example of this was a rather bizarre institution known as the all-mad, all-jesting, all-drunken assembly. This was an institution made up of Peter's closest advisors, a mixture of foreigners and lower-class Russians he met in the foreign quarter, and some noblemen who affiliated to his purposes of westernizing Russia. This drunken assembly, and by the way, the word assembly in Russian here, sobor, is the word used for church councils. Note, that's important. This assembly, this sobor, this drunken assembly, performed elaborate mock rituals, most of them mock religious rituals. All the members of this assembly were given bizarre titles, such as prince, priest, or patriarch, obviously not the real patriarch, or Prince Caesar. Peter never took a high rank. He always was some minor rank, and he usually liked to continue to play the drums, of course. And these ceremonies, which involved, of course, a great deal of drinking, hence the all-drunken part of its title, and often farcical versions of religious ceremonies, sometimes lasted for days on end, occasionally included great parades through the streets, and Peter could usually be found just for good added bizarre quality of it, since these were mock religious rituals and everybody was dressed up as czar and as patriarch and the like. He would usually be wearing a Dutch sailor's suit, which he was had from the time he traveled in the West, and of course, playing his drum. Now, a lot of interpretations have been offered to explain the so-called drunken assembly. And the most common was that this was an attack on the church. This was his rather playful way of saying that the church was a retrograde, traditional institution. Remember the role of the patriarch in turning the country back away from westernization during the time when his mother was basically ruling the country, that this was seen as a part of this move for westernization in a sort of carnivalesque way. No doubt this was part of the meaning of the assembly, but perhaps even more important in telling you something about how Peter as an individual ruled, was the social function of the assembly. This was, in many ways, a lot of fun. This was a way to bring Peter and his men, and they were all men at this stage, together with sort of bonding, a sort of camaraderie among his associates, building up the ties to individuals that he would need in order to know whom to trust in reforming Russia. In other words, the assembly was a way through liquor and through jokes of uniting the men who would really lead the way in transforming Russia. Though the jokes and the iconoclasm still have to be considered as part of its meaning. Also has to be kept in mind in thinking about the way in which Peter's bringing of civilization was a little more complicated than it might seem at first glance. While Peter could be a pretty nice guy some of the time, he was often extremely violent, indeed quite cruel. He almost always carried a club, rather big, heavy club, and if he felt someone needed punishment for not pursuing his work the way it was expected, for not following his policies, for not being completely loyal, he would take the club and beat them. If they were a noble, if they were a friend, if they were a member of the court, when needed, he felt a good clubbing would be just the thing. Most important, and more politically significant than his tendency to clobber people, was brutal suppression of dissent. The very start of his reign, a group of soldiers revolted, again, over the issue of which family would be in charge, this time an attempt to bring back Sophia's family to the throne. Peter had no hesitation in not only suppressing this rebellion, which was against him, but in brutally and violently publicly executing people in the main public squares of Moscow in order to draw attention to what he would not tolerate. He also was a man who loved war. And we'll talk about the importance of war more than once in this course as part of expanding the Russian Empire, of proving its greatness. But there's also, for many rulers, like Peter, pleasure. He personally commanded the army. He enjoyed battle, even if from a slight distance of a commander. He in many ways saw himself as a man of violence, as a royal warrior. Now this brings me to Peter's reforms. Almost from the moment that Peter came to power, he showed himself to be an exceptionally energetic ruler. And in fact, even a very brief summary of his accomplishments is rather impressive. He continued territorial expansion through a variety of wars, most importantly with Sweden, with Charles the XII. And as a result of these successes in war, he became renamed in 1721 as, in Russian, Imperator, as Emperor. Not just as Tsar, though he kept that title as well. This was more modern, more European, more clear that he was now in charge of an empire. He also got the name The Great for his military accomplishments of expanding the empire. In fact, almost his entire reign was taken up with war. There's only one year in the whole reign of Peter the Great where the country was not at war. And of course, the goal was partly expansion, but it was also to win respect for Russia as a great, mighty power, as an empire. And the needs of war, the needs of maintaining war throughout his reign, helped fuel many of his reforms, in particular the creation of a modern army, of a modern navy, but also many of his changes in government and society as well. For example, he sought to rationalize and centralize government administration. In the central administration, he decided that the old bureaucratic structure, however much in advance that might have seemed at one time, was not efficient enough. And he created a new, more Western-seeming system, partly, interestingly, adopted and borrowed from Charles the XII's own government, the very government he fought against. And he knew how strong Charles was, so he thought the system made sense, and adopted a system of what were known as colleges, basically ministries, though run by a committee, that had very clear functions, the College of War, the College of Trade, the College of Mines and Manufacturing, for example. He created a Senate, which was designed as the highest coordinating body. Every member of a college would sit on the Senate, plus other important officials that Peter thought would be useful in advising him. He created a new political police. Policing was something new in Russia. And then this one was particularly aimed at crushing dissent, disloyalty, revolts, criticism of the Tsar or his family, for that matter. He reorganized the map itself of the empire geographically, subdividing the whole nation into provinces and establishing provincial administrations. And he put the church, always a problem for him, as you know, under state control. For one thing, he got rid of the patriarch, the patriarch died and he simply didn't reappoint him, and declared himself head of the church. And to administer the church, he appointed a head of the Holy Synod, a body to administer the church, who had to be a layperson, not a priest, not a bishop. Now, parallel to these efforts to transform society as well as the state, he also was determined to transform society. For example, he created a single, what was called, table of ranks, which all the old nobility born of birth, all the new nobility who acquired their rank through service, was created in one single chart of what it meant to be a nobleman, and it had to be through service. And as you rose through the ranks, you could become a nobleman. Birth was no longer enough. He organized the urban population into guilds and corporations. He built factories, dug mines, established industries. He reformed the entire tax structure. It was a very chaotic tax structure before, basically based on household, which meant people could combine households and get out of paying taxes. He said every individual, the most rational method, every individual had to pay a tax, what was called the soul tax. And he stimulated a Western intellectual life, especially among the elite. Again, very active, transforming everything. Just as he changed the map of Russia, he changed time, just like he changed space, creating a new calendar so that Russians would now start counting years, not as they used to from the beginning of the world, but from the birth of Christ, just as the way Western Europe did. And the year would begin in January, not as it used to begin in September. He rewrote the alphabet. The old Slavonic alphabet wasn't useful for modern techniques, for modern activities. He created, with his own hand, a new secular alphabet. He established printing presses to create books for learning, for information, especially on technical matters. He promoted schools. He established the Academy of Sciences. He established the first universities. Now, when historians try to make sense of all this, certain arguments stand out. First is what might be called one of the leitmotifs of Russian history, what one historian has called the civilizing role of force exerted from above, civilizing force from above. And indeed, Peter, like many before him, believed in the essential connection between power and progress. But this raises the question of what was his vision of progress, what sort of civilization did he want to bring to Russia? In part, as you probably can already see, this was a technical notion of what civilization meant. Rationalization, regularization of laws and government institutions, of society, functionally clear administrative units, technologies to make a modern economy. And in fact, in many ways, all of this was very much in the Russian tradition. Peter believed in his all-powerful might as ruler, his role as Grozny, as awesome, mighty Tsar. And one can see this in his preoccupation, for example, with things military. And indeed, Peter was often compared to the most military of all the gods, when he was compared to a god, to Mars. One of his closest friends had a big palace built and painted a picture of Peter as Mars on the ceiling of the entryway. And one sees other policies similarly in this old authoritarian tradition, nobles forced to serve the state, serfdom intensified, taxation to make sure everybody paid, even a succession law that gave, for the first time, absolute power to the Tsar to appoint whoever he wanted, to choose whoever made the most sense as the next ruler, not leave it to the fate of birth. Still, there's something more than this going on. Despite all of his authoritarianism, despite all of his really persistent personal crudity, despite the fact that he seemed mostly interested in the West for its technical accomplishments, still, Westernization meant more, in Peter's mind, than just this. He wanted Russia to become, as he would have called it, civilized. He hated the look of old Russia, and he did everything he could to eradicate it, for the sake, at the very least, of Russia's dignity in the world. He insisted on Western dress for everybody now in the elite. Western wigs had to be worn. He personally cut off those hated Muscovite beards of everybody in court and insisted no one wear them any further. He replaced Muscovite social customs as well with European ones, not only ordering Western dress for everybody at court, but holding altogether new social events, balls, for example, or European-type gatherings that he called assemblée, using the French word, assemblies, at which women were to be included, ending the tradition of seclusion of women from public company in Russia. He introduced Western names for things. The very look, the sound of Russia should change. If you walked into Peter the Great's court, you might, the first person you might meet would perhaps be the Obergofmarschall, or perhaps the Oberzeremoniemeister. All totally Western words, given a bit of a Russian accent, is all into the Russian court. And intensified a trend earlier to build Western-looking palaces with Western architects and create a new Western capital to exemplify this, which he called Sankt Peterburg, or what became known as Sankt Peterburg, St. Petersburg, a very Western notion. In a way, you can see, you might say these are all external things. These are concerned with form. Peter, like many in the 18th century and late 17th century, believed, though, that external things affect what's inside you, that clothes, as it were, makes the man. And these clothes, these symbols, these surfaces were also meant to convey something, as well as to transform you within, to convey what sort of country Russia was supposed to be, a civilized one. And one could see all of this most clearly in Peter's greatest creation, the city of St. Petersburg. The capital he built on the northern swamps, taken in battle from Sweden. Unlike the old capital with its narrow, winding streets and churches and monasteries all in a very traditional style, Petersburg was in every respect a symbol of Western, secular power, order, and rationality. You could see it in the very layout of the city. Instead of winding streets, it's on a perfect grid. Squares and triangles shape its pattern. And it's imposed on the worst possible surface for this, on a swamp with meandering streams. It was an imposition of order on nature itself. And one sees this city design, in city other aspects of city design and architecture, one sees the same logic. Gardens were created in a European, orderly style, laid out in geometric rows. Churches should be built in a Baroque and neoclassical style, not churches such as the old Muscovite St. Basil's you see here, built in the time of Ivan the Fourth, of Ivan the Terrible, which looked so Muscovite, like the brocaded robes itself. Churches should look European. These are surface changes, again, to be sure, but they're meant to show the world Russians were not savages. Russians were not bears, and to teach Russians to act in a more civilized manner. In other words, clearly, Peter the Great transformed the very shape of modern Russian life, as Russians themselves well understood. And I'd like you just for a moment to listen to words by a noted Russian intellectual, a man named Mikhail Pogodin, writing in the mid-19th century. And this is just portions of a rather long encomium to Peter the Great. Yes, Peter the Great did much for Russia. We encounter him everywhere. We wake up. What day is it? January 1st, 1841. Ah, Peter the Great ordered us to count the years from the birth of Christ. Peter the Great ordered us to count the months from January. It's time to dress. Our clothing is made according to the fashion established by Peter the Great. A book strikes our eyes. Peter the Great introduced this script and himself cut out the letters. Newspapers are brought in. Peter the Great introduced them. You must buy different things. They all remind you of Peter the Great. Some he ordered. Others were brought into use or improved by him, carried on his ships, in his harbors, on his canals, on his roads. At dinner, all the courses from salted herring through potatoes, which he ordered grown, to wine made from grapes, which he began to cultivate, will speak to you of Peter the Great. After dinner, you drive out for a visit. This is an assemblée of Peter the Great. You meet ladies there. They were admitted into masculine company by order of Peter the Great. You receive a rank according to Peter the Great's table of ranks. And you decide to travel abroad, following the example of Peter the Great, you'll be received well. For Peter the Great placed Russia among the European states and began to instill respect for her, and so on and so on and so on, he says. Of course, one can't forget other people prepared all of this for this process of Westernization. But no one dared to act the way Peter did. Other people created a political system that enabled Russia to make these changes, but no one had ever used this power so boldly. Next time, we'll consider how Peter's successors handled this legacy, especially when it fell into the hands of a succession of empresses in the 18th century.
Lecture 4, The Age of Empresses, Catherine the Great.
One of the intriguing facts about Russian history in the 18th century is that for most of that century after the death of Peter the Great in 1725, most of the country was ruled, most of the time was ruled by women, by empresses. And this lecture explores just this age of empresses, as it might be called, especially the very important reigns of Elizabeth, Peter's daughter, and of course of Catherine the Second or Catherine the Great. We'll be considering their actions and their reforms, and of course, very importantly, their relationship to the whole Petrine legacy of Westernization, but especially looking at the particular ideas and ideals and values that inspired them. First, though, it's useful to frame this with a brief overview of the succession of rulers following the death of Peter I. From 1725 to 27, for just a couple of years, Peter the Great's second wife, Catherine I, as she was known, ruled Russia. And she was evidently Peter's own choice of heir. He actually crowned her as his empress, though he never actually declared who should follow him in power, though he retained the right to do just that. What's striking is that, like everything, Peter chose somebody who wasn't necessarily born to a role. She was not from noble background. In fact, she was a former servant girl, and she was not even Russian. She was from the Baltic provinces. She was Estonian or Latvian or Lithuanian, depending on who you read. In fact, she was also, rather typical of Peter, the former lover of one of his closest advisors, Alexander Menshikov, but he decided he preferred her, and Menshikov, of course, had to accept that. Her reign really had one major achievement, which would become significant later. She created a council, what was called the Supreme Privy Council, of advisors, high nobles, but also notables who had risen to their role in the court under Peter I, whatever their background. But mostly, increasingly, high nobles ran the Supreme Privy Council and advised the Tsar. After Catherine's death, Peter the Great's 12-year-old grandson came to the throne, who was known as Peter II, who ruled very briefly. After less than 3 years on the throne, he died of smallpox, which also notably brought to the end the male line of the Romanov dynasty. He ruled only 1727 to 30. There's a rather intriguing side note to the reign of Peter II. He's the only male ruler in the 18th century after Peter who ruled for more than a few months, as you'll see in a moment. But given that, in his short time as the only real substantial male ruler in the 18th century after Peter, he made a rather startling brief effort to reverse, at least partly, Peter the Great's reforms. He tried to bring the old aristocratic families back to court, throwing out many of Peter's closest associates, people often of non-noble background, who rose on the basis of merit and service. He even briefly and highly symbolically transferred the capital away from St. Petersburg to Moscow, a turning back to the old. Still, he couldn't really undo the fundamental westernization that had taken place in Peter's time, because the culture in many ways of the nobles, despite these efforts, was still quite Western. In 1730, for 10 years until 1740, the empress became Anna, who was the daughter of Ivan V, Peter's co-tsar. She was known actually at first for cooperating with the high aristocracy. In fact, she was basically given the throne by the Supreme Privy Council, which also said, while you're agreeing to taking the throne, you must agree to certain conditions, as they called them, which would ensure that the high aristocracy had a dominant role, would control the guards troops, often used in helping to bring people to the throne, and also would be able to control a great deal of policy. She accepted this for a rather short time, and then decided that's not the way a Russian autocrat ought to be, tore up the conditions, insisted on her absolute rights to autocracy, began to do everything she could to limit the power of the high aristocracy, including abolishing the Supreme Privy Council as interfering too much in her reign. She also became notably brutal, not only in these manners, but also in arresting and executing religious dissenters of all sorts, as well as many other criminals, so much so that she became known to history as Bloody Anna. Just before she died, following Peter the Great's rule that you can appoint your own successor, she named a two-month-old baby, her great-nephew, Ivan, who became known as Ivan VI, who ruled in 1740 rather briefly. She also chose as regent her lover, a German man named Ernst Johann Biron, to serve as regent with a two-month-old baby. Obviously, he had full power. But within just a few months, little Ivan VI, along with Biron and what was called the German party, were overthrown with the Guards troops, who often played this role of the nobility interfering in who should reign. Ivan VI was replaced on the throne, really Biron was replaced on the throne, by Elizabeth, the daughter of Peter the Great and Catherine I. And she ruled Russia for a full 20 years, from 1741 to 1761. Hers is a very important reign in some respects, and I'll say more about it in a moment. When Elizabeth died, she was replaced by her nephew, Peter, who became known as Peter III, who ruled for only about six months. He made many, many enemies and was overthrown by Guards troops and replaced by his wife, a German woman, who became known as Catherine II, or Catherine the Great. She ruled for 34 years, from 1762 to 1796. Now, women ruled Russia in the 18th century for a number of reasons, partly because, as I've already noted, Peter made this possible. In 1722, faced with a son who was clearly disloyal, he decreed a monarch could designate anybody he wanted as successor, male, female, relative, not a relative, noble, a common person, whoever he wanted. Partly the design here was to strengthen the power of the autocrat. There should be no limit on the will of the ruler. But also, this was a reflection of his rationalist, sort of utilitarian ideals. Why should the accidents of biology, and as he well knew in the Romanov family, the accidents of biology did not always produce the greatest offsprings, why should this determine who should have such an important matter as ruling Russia? Simply not rational. Another problem, of course, was that was a rather shortage of able males. Adults, many of them didn't live very long, many were not quite healthy, many of them were not quite sane, in fact, and therefore, because there was a choice, women were often chosen. No less important, though, had to do with the rising power of the noblemen, of the aristocracy, and particularly of the aristocratic guards regiments. They enjoyed their growing power, they continually tried to reassert it, and they thought, remember Anna, who they were wrong about, they thought women would simply be more pliable, more agreeable. They were women, after all. They'd listen to them. They'd give them a greater voice at court. Whatever the intentions, one thing is clear. These women, at least certain of them, were not passive rulers. They did much to bring their own vision to the throne and in many ways to shape the Petrine legacy in new ways. And this is most visible in the two most substantial reigns of women in the 18th century, Elizabeth and Catherine II. And concerning Elizabeth, who again ruled from 1741 to 1761, it has to be said first that there was an interesting difference in personality between Elizabeth and her father, Peter the Great. On the one hand, she was greatly admired, like Peter, but for very different reasons. She was beautiful. She was charming. She was friendly to everyone. And of course, after the rule of Anna and the domination of Biron and the so-called German party, she seemed to promise more respect for Russians, more respect for nobles especially, and to convey a more gentle spirit. In a way, one might say, Elizabeth was simply too charming. Unlike her energetic and forceful father, determined to transform Russia, to build things, Elizabeth was notoriously indolent and pleasure-loving. If Peter really loved Western goods, Western machinery, Western technique, for Elizabeth, what she really loved were French clothes. Still, she did a lot to continue Peter's legacy. She led further efforts to routinize and rationalize government institutions, something that was always going on among these westernizing elites. She also, more characteristic of her and her tastes, did a lot more to encourage cultural development, in particular founding a number of important institutions of higher education, especially Moscow University. Petersburg University already existed, founded by Peter. She stimulated the economy, for example, abolishing custom barriers, which divided the country within itself. She encouraged entrepreneurship by noblemen. In foreign policy, she did a lot also to demonstrate that Russia was truly a European great power, participating in various coalitions and wars, and most notably, most impressively, defeating Prussia as one of the allies in the Seven Years' War, and even being able to briefly occupy Berlin with Russian armies in 1760, a wonderful influence, a symbol of what Russia had achieved as a great power. There are also, though, some new elements in this, what might be called a Petrine formula. One way of describing these might be as a sort of feminine ideal of progress. Now, I don't mean this in the sense of supposedly natural differences between the way men and women look at the world, but in a truly historical sense, as an echo, in other words, of values that were conventionally associated with women in European culture, and hence elite Russian culture, in the 18th century. And one sees this choice to associate herself with what were seen in European culture at the time as female values in a number of ways, in particular in Elizabeth I's a particular attention to bringing a spirit of culturedness, of civilization, and even one might describe it as beauty to Russia. And this, of course, for this was part of it, was to show that Russia was not a savage land, but in this case in an even more visible way than Peter, a more gentle way, one might say. Now, where Peter's approach was to show Russians Europeanness through improved technologies and improved science, Elizabeth, though she didn't neglect science and technique, was much more preoccupied with aesthetics, with beauty. As a result, for example, she built, or in a few cases had totally rebuilt, some of Russia's most important, most elegant royal palaces, almost invariably designed by Italian architects. The most famous examples of these are known throughout the world. The Winter Palace, now the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, built by an Italian architect, designed by an Italian architect named Bartolomeo Rastrelli, built in the middle of the 18th century, 1754 to 64, was one of her most famous examples of bringing this Western aesthetic to Russia. At Peterhof, a summer residency, a great palace was built also by Rastrelli. And finally, at another residence, the Tsars had a lot of residences, what was called the Catherine Palace, named in honor of her mother, Catherine I, built at Tsarskoye Selo, also, again, Rastrelli doing the designs. Beautiful, elegant Western palaces. Parallel to all this and connected, Elizabeth promoted what might be called a cult of happiness in Russian public life. This cult of happiness was visible really just about everywhere you looked. For example, odes about the ruler at the time spoke of the happiness that she brought to Russia, of the love and kindness with which she ruled. Just as an example, here's one ode written by what was Russia's most famous poet at the time, Mikhail Lomonosov, at the time of her coronation in 1742. I quote, "She resurrects the universe, renews nature for us, covers the fields with flowers again. And so kindness and love and the bright gaze of Peter's daughter enlivens us with a new life." One could see here in a way a sort of secular version of the part of the tradition of Russian rulers known as the Tishaishi Tsar, the gentle, tender, loving Tsar, though here in a much more secular form than the original notion, which was primarily religious. I should say that this ideal of love was also in many ways echoed, in a strange but not irrelevant way, in Elizabeth's private life. She had no husband and spent her time going through a rather long succession of lovers, not as many as Catherine II, but we'll get to her. And all of this was done in a most visible way, a most public way. This wasn't just a private matter. This was treated as a matter of right, and indeed of the value she placed on pleasure above all things. Part of her style of bringing beauty and westernization and pleasure and happiness to Russia. All these trends in many ways were developed further in the even more important reign of Catherine II. As I noted, Catherine came to the throne in a matter that had become troublingly to some common in the 18th century. Her predecessor was overthrown by officers and soldiers of the elite guards regiments. In her case, of course, her predecessor was her very own husband, Peter III. And one of the reasons that Peter was seen as intolerable and was overthrown by guards regiments representing the elite was his extreme pro-German orientation. In a sense, it's important to keep in mind that there are limits to how much westernization was going to be tolerated. The problem here isn't the fact that he was partly German. He was, of course, partly German. He was the son of Peter I's daughter Anna, not the Anna who ruled, but Elizabeth's sister, actually, and a German duke that she had married. And the problem wasn't his blood. Indeed, this wasn't exceptional at all. In order to establish strong dynastic ties with European monarchs, the Russian elite and the Russian royal family did what most European elites and monarchies were doing, namely marrying, in this case, non-Russians. It was going on throughout the 18th century. The problem was his excessive foreign orientation. He was, of course, personally raised in Germany, where his father was from, and brought back to Russia by his aunt, Elizabeth, and groomed for the throne. But he made it clear that he hated absolutely everything about Russia. He hated its church. In fact, at one point, considered converting to Lutheranism, something a ruler of Russia couldn't possibly do, but he thought it would be a good idea. Maybe everybody should convert to Lutheranism. He hated the Russian language, found it quite ugly, preferred German. And he spent as much time as possible among his German friends. Even more seriously, everything about his policy was pro-German, in this case really pro-Prussian, to the point that after this great victory over Prussia in the Seven Years' War with troops occupying Berlin, he said, no thanks, I actually won't take any concessions, I won't demand anything from you, I'm actually far more supportive of Prussia's interests than Russia, so it seemed to many. He was also, it's worth adding, an intolerable individual in many other respects. He was crude, he was boorish, he was obnoxious, he made horrible bodily noises in public settings, and many people said he was also a rather stupid man. So many people were happy to get him out of the way. Now, Catherine II, of course, was even less Russian than Peter III. In fact, it's worth remembering she was 100% German. She was born, her original name, she's a princess, was Sophie Augusta of Anhalt-Zerbst. The difference was between her and her husband, not that she was more German, she was, this wasn't a problem though, is that she understood that her authority depended on serving Russia first of all, something Peter III did not seem to recognize. In fact, when she came to the throne, she indicated that she intended to consult with the elite above all. And most importantly, that while she favored continued westernization, as I'll describe in more detail in a moment, she made it clear that the purpose of these reforms was not to make Russia simply more Western, but to make Russia stronger, more powerful, more respected in the world. Now, to understand all this, one has to start with looking at her major actions as a ruler, her major reforms. And then we can talk about some of the patterns and logic, the ideas that one finds there. First major question that Catherine turned to was the codification of laws. Now remember, the last time the Russian laws were compiled and revised to make sure they were completely consistent with one another was in 1649. Catherine wanted to fix the various inconsistencies, clarify what the laws were, but she also wanted, in codifying the laws, to bring Russian law up to modern European standards. And to do this, she formed a special body, very interesting organization, national organization, which she called the Legislative Commission. This was in 1767. This was made up of delegates from all over the country, from propertied classes, from townspeople, officials, state peasants, serfs, though were not included, and notably enough, the clergy was not included either, whom she didn't particularly trust to bring enlightened ideas to Russian rule. And she presented them with a really remarkable text, what she called her instruction to the Legislative Commission, Nakaz, in Russia, and she described what sort of legal principles she wanted to guide them. In short, these were the principles of enlightened Western Europe, but I'll say more about this in a moment. In practice, though, it's worth noting that nothing really emerged from this. There were too many divisions among members, and Catherine actually decided to close the whole thing down after a year, partly because she began to worry that they might pass laws that would limit her autocratic power, which she thought was, of course, not helpful for progress. There are other important reforms worth noting as a sort of introduction to her efforts. She restructured, as some of her predecessors, like Peter had, the whole central administration to make procedures and departments more efficient. She also accepted one of the few popular decisions of Peter III. Peter III decided it was all right to abolish the requirement for state service. You didn't have to serve anymore if you were a nobleman. You could go out on your estates and do something else. Catherine thought this was very useful, to have nobles back in the country, back in the localities, building up local administration. She gave them an alternative form of service and endorsed this rule. She also legislated major reforms in how the localities were administered. She reorganized the provinces. These powerful rulers like to transform maps in some ways. She reorganized the boundaries of provinces to make them what she considered more logical. She established noble assemblies, gatherings of local nobility, to take more part in local life. She created a new provincial court system. She established boards of welfare to help the needy, the beginning of philanthropy in Russia. And she established also new urban institutions to manage and run these growing cities in Russia at this time, including giving them some measure of local self-government. She also, and you see this is similar to Peter, but a continuation, she promoted, much more like Elizabeth than Peter, education and culture. Though Peter started this as well. She allowed for the first time in Russian history private publishing, private printing. She promoted schools, free public primary and secondary schools. She worked to develop the economy in many important ways, gave out loans to nobles, gave various incentives to help them develop new technologies, new techniques of agriculture. She also made available various loans to business owners to try to build up the urban industrial economy. And, of course, connected to all of this, part of, again, the tradition in which she was continuing, she did what she could to build up the expansion, the size of the Russian Empire, again, enhancing Russia's status as a great power. Most importantly, she fought wars to expand the reach, the territory of the Russian Empire, including expanding into what then was Poland, what later became Poland, which she seized and divided in its partition with other European powers. She also moved into the areas around the Black Sea, finally reaching the sort of southern geographic reach of the empire by taking Crimea after a victory in a war with Turkey, who Russia was constantly fighting. And as a result of these territorial acquisitions, she also got her title, the Great, Catherine the Great. Now, why did she do all this? What do we know about how she thought about these various purposes of power that she was using in this modernizing way? In part, we know she was inspired, she tells us so all the time, by Enlightenment ideas about the need for greater human freedom, for greater equal rights, for democracy in the world. For example, we can see this in her famous instruction, which she presented to the participants, the delegates to the Legislative Commission in 1767. She argued about the need for reform in Russia according to key Enlightenment ideas. She said, first of all, remember, Russia is a European state. We must start from that foundation. She went on to say that the purpose of monarchy is, and I quote, not to deprive people of their natural liberty, but to correct their actions in order to attain the supreme good. She went on to say legitimate monarchy had to be founded on fundamental laws, the rule of law, that all citizens are equal and hence subject to the same laws, that every individual, she said, whatever their